The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies. An estimated 3.5 million Americans suffer from hepatitis C. That's the most deadly infectious disease in the United States. And it's just one of the hepatitis strains out there. Florida recently declared a health emergency over outbreaks of hepatitis A, which is vaccine preventable. Viral hepatitis causes more than a million deaths every year, and that number is rising. But 9 out of 10 people who are infected, they don't even know it. How's that possible? What can we do about it? We're going to see what we can find out about that today. Joining us is Dr. Hope Hubbard, Associate Professor of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio and Hepatology Director at the Robert B. Green Clinic, and is board certified in gastroenterology. Also with us, Dr. Naeem Alkhouri, the director of the Metabolic Center at the Texas Liver Institute, also associate professor of medicine at UT Health San Antonio, and Lauren Canary, epidemiologist and director of the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Let's start with, we know that hepatitis is a virus. Let's start with you, Dr. Hubbard. Just tell us more about that virus.
A virus in general?
Yeah. What is hepatitis?
So hepatitis is inflammation of the liver. So mm-hmm. hep is liver and itis is inflammation. So a virus causing liver inflammation.
Okay, and so we have a veritable alphabet of strains of this virus. So who would like to start off with hepatitis A, which is the one that's coming up a lot recently? We've got the health emergency in Florida, problems in Mississippi, really all around the country. What's hepatitis A?
So hepatitis A is one of the viral hepatitis. It's typically transmitted through what we call the oral fecal route. So typically you have a food handler in a restaurant, someone who doesn't wash their hands, they're infected with hepatitis A, and they can give it to a bunch of people, and that's why hand hygiene is very important. It could also be transmitted in men who have sex with men. Sometimes it's common in homeless communities. There was a recent outbreak in San Diego that was mainly in the homeless community. They had hepatitis A. Typically, it's a self-limited illness, so you have this incubation period that lasts, roughly speaking, about 2 to 4 weeks, and then you start having symptoms. The symptoms can be very nonspecific. They feel like you have the flu, so maybe fever, chills, fatigue. Some people turn yellow, jaundice, and this is a classic sign of viral hepatitis. You may have also dark urine, and typically after a couple of weeks, most people will recover spontaneously. However, there is a chance, 1 in 1,000 or so, that you may develop what we call acute liver failure from hepatitis A, and that's why we take it very seriously. And this is more common in patients that have underlying liver diseases, whether it's alcoholic liver disease or fatty liver disease. If you have acute hepatitis A on top of that, you can end up with acute liver failure. Typically, hepatitis A does not become chronic, so it's typically an acute illness, although you can have a relapsing course where it lasts for a few weeks or a few months. Typically, again, it's self-limited, but the main concern is developing acute liver failure.
All right. I didn't mention our phone number. We do want callers to call in with questions about any of the hepatitis viruses, treatment, prevention, that kind of thing, for our experts at 210-614-8980. That's 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, or you can tweet us at TPR Source. Okay, so Dr. Alkhouri, it's vaccine preventable, this particular strain, hepatitis A. So why are we having these outbreaks?
So hepatitis A is absolutely preventable by the vaccine, and actually the vaccine has been recommended to all infants in the United States since 2006. So the young generation, most people are actually immunized against hepatitis A. But, you know, older people, historically speaking, we did not have the vaccine being recommended. So if you haven't been exposed to hepatitis A, you're still at risk. And as I said, you know, certain groups have also higher chances of acquiring hepatitis A. So I think this is what's starting these epidemics. Historically speaking, hepatitis A has been also more common in southern states, especially in Texas. It's also more common in Mexico. I think, you know, hepatitis A is kind of like a quick infection. It comes in these epidemics. You have, you know, a few hundred cases. You end up with a few fatalities, and then it goes away, and then it comes back. I think as we vaccinate more and more people, we're going to see hopefully less of these infections. But at this point, we're not at a level where we have enough immunity in the population to avoid these epidemics.
Lauren Canary is with us. She's an epidemiologist by trade. Lauren, why do you think we're still seeing the spread of these viruses when in some cases we have vaccines and we pretty much know how to not spread them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been quite striking. Classically, we would think of Hep A outbreaks and these sort of limited clusters associated with perhaps a foodborne outbreak. But this recent outbreak that started out in San Diego has just kind of taken over the country like wildfire. It's up to over 23,000 cases, and most of those people have had to be hospitalized. And we're even seeing hundreds of deaths from this outbreak. So I think this represents sort of a new normal in hepatitis A and its transmission, especially among people that may be experiencing homelessness or people that use drugs. And given that these are communities that are already highly stigmatized, I think we really need to be investing in viral hepatitis so we can make sure we're reaching these folks who classically have been stigmatized by the healthcare system.
Dr. Hubbard, for this strain, hepatitis A, to be more deadly in this case, is something changed?
I don't think anything has changed. I think that, you know, if patients have an immune, a compromised immune system, or if they're older, if they have any history of prior chronic liver disease such as cirrhosis, then they may not be able to fight the infection. If they already have an impaired liver function, then they're going to be more likely to suffer those consequences compared to someone that's maybe younger and healthier who in those cases would be a self-limited virus where they'll feel bad for a few weeks or a month or so, and then they'll tend to recover from that permanently.
So the homeless population would be particularly vulnerable to a virus like this.
Yes.
Yes, let's talk about hepatitis C, which now has curative treatment. I've read over the years that many of those positive for hepatitis C are from that age group. Why is that, Dr. Hubbard?
We're not really sure. We do know that age group, those born between 1945 and 1965, are the ones that should be screened, and they comprise up to 75% of those who have a chronic infection. And the interesting thing is a lot of them don't have an obvious risk factor. So we think about hepatitis C, we think of someone who maybe injected drugs or maybe tattoos, prior blood transfusions. But some of these patients don't have an obvious risk factor for transmission. So it's a little bit confounding, but those patients tend to have higher risk, and by the time they're diagnosed, can tend to have cirrhosis or liver cancer because they've had an undiagnosed infection for 20 or 30 years.
Okay, so we'll talk more about that straight ahead. Also, there's an emerging population, I understand, that is seeing an increase in hepatitis C infections. Also about B, D, and E, everything you need to know. And if you have questions or thoughts about this, give us a call, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org, or you can add us on Twitter at TPR Source. That's our handle there. You are listening to The Source. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. And here we are. You're listening to The Source. on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies, and we're talking about hepatitis A, B, C, D, and E. Do you have a question or a story to tell about hepatitis? Have you been tested, screened, or contracted any strain? What do you want to know about how these viruses spread and how they're treated? You can give us a call. And our number, again, is 210-614-8980. And you can remain anonymous, so we can just talk about this anonymously. Give us a call, and we will talk. And we were talking just before the break about baby boomers and hepatitis C, and I was going to talk about an increase in all ages because of the opioid epidemic. Is that something you're seeing, Dr. Hubbard?
We're definitely seeing that in our clinic. These tend to be younger patients in their 20s, 30s, relatively healthy, who are unfortunately are addicted to drugs, and they're injecting drugs and are getting hepatitis C.
So since we know that there is a large population of people who's positive for any of these strains of the virus and don't know it, you mentioned screening when we were on the break. Tell me about that.
So the baby boomers should be screened. Those born between 1945 and 1965 be one-time lifetime screening. If they're negative, there's nothing else to do. But if they're positive, they should have a confirmatory test to document an active infection, and then they can be provided care at that point. And then people who have risk factors, anyone who's injected drugs or you shared instruments to snort drugs, patients who have HIV, high-risk sexual behavior, anyone who's had prior blood transfusions before 1992, those patients should be screened for hepatitis C as well. Active injection drug use, they should be screened at least once a year because they have that current risk factor for infection.
So one of our listeners wants to talk about Hep B a little bit, and we touched on that during the break. Tell me, what's the difference between Hep B and the other hepatitis strains?
So hepatitis B is passed by blood. Similar to hepatitis C in that it's passed by infected blood. So typically in this country, we see it in patients who share needles to inject drugs, high risk of sexual transmission as well. So we do see that. And then the other interesting thing is it's very common in other parts of the world. So people who were born in Africa, Asia, India, Europe, the Middle East, a lot of times they get the virus passed to them by their mother when they were born. So pregnant women can pass on to their children. And as a child, the patients tend to have a chronic infection. And so anyone born in those countries should be screened for hepatitis B.
So Jessa on Twitter asks us, how long can a person live with hepatitis B without diagnosis or treatment?
Well, we know that up to 25% of those patients can develop a chronic liver disease. They can get cirrhosis, liver cancer, chronic hepatitis, if it's not treated. So that would be their approximate risk of developing a chronic liver disease with an untreated infection.
Okay, Jessa also wants to know, can you, going back to Hep A, can you recover from hepatitis A without treatment?
Yeah, I think this is the norm, actually, that most people with hepatitis A will have this self-limited illness, and then they will go back to having a fully normal liver. So the rule is recovery. Again, the you know, cases we worry about is the patients that, you know, go into liver failure. But this is not a common thing, but we're seeing more and more cases just because we have so many people infected. But most people with hepatitis A will actually cure the hepatitis A spontaneously, and there is no risk of developing chronic hepatitis with hepatitis A. So it's typically an acute illness.
All right, let's take a question from a caller. We have David on the phone. David, what's your question?
Hi, yes. So I'm an extensive traveler, so my experience has been through Central America that a lot of ministries down there, health departments, don't have that same level of requirement that we do. And so I'm definitely not trying to say that this is something that migrants bring, but I'm wondering, as people come to the United States, what do we as the U.S. do to support getting them immunized at an appropriate level to mirror, you know, them as they join us in our country?
Let's go to Lauren on that. Lauren Kaderi, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's an important topic. And I know we have policies in terms of people that are immigrating to get vaccinated for hepatitis B, but we know that many folks are missed by these requirements. So
Anyone who is traveling from a foreign-born country, especially those countries in Africa, India, China, kind of Eastern Europe, should be getting vaccinated for Hep B and getting tested. And I'm glad that, callers are bringing up hepatitis B because it's often overlooked in our fight against viral hepatitis, but it actually was the first disease for which we had a vaccine that could prevent cancer. Hepatitis B is one of the leading causes of liver cancer, which has actually hit Texas quite hard. I do understand it has the highest age-adjusted incidence of liver cancer in the entire country. So the hepatitis B vaccine is a great tool for fighting that.
That's interesting because it reminds me of something that I was talking to Dr. Alcuri about, which is the high prevalence of fatty liver disease in Texas, and that exacerbates problems related to hepatitis. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. If you have underlying liver disease and then you get a viral hepatitis on top of it, you may have more aggressive disease. And unfortunately, we do have an epidemic of what we call fatty liver disease in South Texas. And fatty liver disease comes from one of two sources. Number one is obesity, and we have an issue with the obesity epidemic, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome. We call it non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. But also excessive alcohol consumption can cause fatty liver disease, and this is alcoholic liver disease. And these diseases can progress to the point that the patients develop liver cirrhosis and stage liver disease. And actually, today in Texas, the number one indication for liver transplantation in women is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and the number one indication in men is alcoholic liver disease. And again, if you have these diseases, even if you did not progress to cirrhosis, if you get acute hepatitis A on top of these diseases, you can progress to acute liver failure. So that's why we do recommend hepatitis A and hepatitis B vaccine for every patient with chronic liver disease, whether it's from alcohol, from obesity, or even autoimmune liver disease. Everyone with a history of chronic liver disease should be vaccinated for hepatitis A and hepatitis B.
We could do a whole show, or probably 10, on fatty liver disease.
We absolutely should, because we need to educate the public on this. And today we don't have any FDA-approved treatments, but we actually have a lot in the pipeline. And I expect within a year or so, we will have some medications that we can use to treat fatty liver disease outside of weight loss and management of diabetes. And this is going to hopefully be a game changer for us. So we need to spread the word and tell people that it's not just losing weight, it's not just lifestyle modifications. And in fact, we do have a lot of these clinical trials at the Texas Liver Institute where patients can be treated with these new medications, and hopefully we can establish safety and efficacy in the near future.
We'll definitely talk about research before we end this hour, but let's go now to the phone. Again, you can call at 210-614-8980. And Bill, what's your question?
Yeah, hi. I was in the Army in the mid-'80s. I don't know if I received a hepatitis immunization shot when I was in the Army then. I'd like to know if anyone can answer that question. My primary question is, when I got out of the Army and I was working for a small company, they gave me the hepatitis A immunizations. It's a series of two shots. And so I'm protected against hepatitis A, but my question is whether I should be concerned about the other types of hepatitis, because I'm a senior. I'm over 70 years old.
Both my doctors are nodding their heads. Dr. Hubbard?
Yes, I think with your age and with your prior military experience, you're at risk for having those infections. So you can go to your doctor, and a simple blood test can let you know if you have been immunized adequately to hepatitis B. And if you haven't been, you can be vaccinated. So a blood test from your doctor can show that.
Anything to add, doctor?
No, I think the message is that if anyone is interested in receiving vaccines for hepatitis A and B, that they should be able to receive these vaccines, okay? And we're trying to push for this, especially with the new hepatitis A epidemic. So if anyone expresses interest in getting vaccinated, regardless of risk factors or, you know, the year they're born or previous illnesses, they should be able to get the vaccine.
Yeah, I'm a mom, and I spend a lot of time talking to other moms, and I've heard a certain, you know, faction of parents saying they don't want to give their babies hepatitis vaccines because what do they need them for as infants? What would you say to a parent who asked that question?
Well, I think you can prevent a liver disease, whether it's an acute hepatitis or a chronic infection. There are some women who are infected with hepatitis B, hepatitis C, that could, in theory, pass it on to their children. So that's something to think about. But these vaccines are safe, they're effective, and I think they could prevent illness. So I would certainly disagree with anyone who would not want to vaccinate their child from these viruses.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 210-614-8980. LB is on the line. What's your question, LB?
Hi. I too had hepatitis C in the 90s. Back then, I went through what was called a combo treatment of interferon and ribavirin, and the interferon was injections in the stomach. I went through that two different times, and they think they got the hepatitis C, but I did end up with some liver damage from it, and I just wondered, I mean, is this something that I should feel like I just always need to check it for the rest of my life? Are there new things I can take to help, or am I just at this crossroads that I'm going to stay at? And I guess that's about it.
Dr. Alkhouri?
Yeah, this is a great question, and I'm sorry that you had to go through the interferon injections. This used to be painful, and you had to take it for a year, sometimes longer. The treatment for hepatitis C has changed dramatically over the past 5 years, so now the cure rate is 99%, and it's typically one pill that you have to take daily for 8 to 12 weeks, and the side effects are very minimal: headache, occasional nausea, insomnia, but they're very manageable. So the key question is, did you develop cirrhosis before you're cured from hepatitis C? And if this is the case, then that will require lifelong follow-up to check for the risk of developing liver cancer, because that risk remains. Although it goes way down after curing hepatitis C, it does not subside completely. So you would need ultrasounds every 6 months or so to check for early liver cancer. If you did not have cirrhosis and you cured hepatitis C, typically your liver should regenerate and you should be okay. We used to do biopsies to determine this, but now we have a simple test called FibroScan that measures the stiffness of the liver, and it can tell you with accuracy if you have cirrhosis or not. So I would highly recommend you see a liver specialist or a gastroenterologist, get the FibroScan test done, and then we can help guide you if you need lifelong follow-up or you can be actually discharged from a hepatology clinic.
All right, we're going to talk more about the treatment for hepatitis C in the next half hour, mostly because it's so expensive and it's out of reach for many people. So we will touch on that and stick around for that. Lauren Canary is with us on the line. You are the director of the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable. What is that?
Sure. So we're a coalition with over 500 members across the country. We're working to try to support states in eliminating hepatitis B and hepatitis C, of course, getting folks vaccines for hepatitis A. We recently were able to bring together patient advocates who have had a lived experience with hep C. They came from across the country. We all met up in Atlanta and kind of talked about our priorities going forward. So we're really looking forward to bringing patients into this conversation as states move forward with plans to eliminate viral hepatitis, ensuring that their voices are heard.
And what are your ultimate goals?
We'd love to see states across the country dropping their treatment restrictions, firstly, for hepatitis C. A lot of states, given that these new drugs came out in 2014 with a really high price tag, a lot of Medicaid programs placed restrictions on treatment, deciding who could and couldn't get access. And now that the prices have come down, there's really no excuse for keeping this practice in place. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid have made it clear that this practice is illegal. So that's my first priority as new director here, is to really get rid of those treatment restrictions. And we are seeing that in Texas. Texas is actually one of the strictest states when it comes to these treatment restrictions for hepatitis C.
All right, we'll talk about more about that straight ahead when we talk about the cost of treatment for hep C. Give us a call, 210-614-8980. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies.
Remember the Alamo. But how do we remember it? As the 1836 battle site, as a historic mission, as a cemetery.
This really is a project unlike really any other that you're talking about, a battle site and the mission site that has been around for generations.
The latest on the renovations at the Alamo, next time on Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie in for David Martin Davies. We're talking about hepatitis, and we want to hear from you if you have questions or stories to tell about your experience with hepatitis. Have you been tested or contracted a strain? What do you want to know about the viruses, how they're spread, how they're treated? Give us a call. You can remain anonymous at 210-614-8980. And Lauren Canary at the National Virus Hepatitis Roundtable touched on something during the last break that I'd like to explore a little bit more. So we now have this treatment, effective treatment for hepatitis C, and it costs something like $56,000 to $94,000 in a year, and Texas Medicaid restricts coverage to the sickest, only to the sickest patients who already have liver damage. So what good is a treatment if you can't get it? And Dr. Alkhouri, I see your face responding to my thoughts here.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right that these treatments, when they first came out, they came at a very high price, but the price has dropped dramatically. So we're talking about around still very high, $20,000.
Yeah.
But we do have restrictions in Texas, and this really breaks my heart. I mean, I think everyone with chronic hepatitis C should be treated, and we should not have any restrictions. So the restrictions we have are related to the severity of the disease. So patients need to have advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis before they qualify. Once you get to that point, you're at risk for liver cancer. You will need lifelong follow-up. So the idea is that you should be treated early on so we can actually tell you you're cured from hepatitis C and you don't need lifelong follow-up. The other restriction they have is related sometimes to substance abuse, including marijuana, which I don't think should actually be a cause to deny anyone hepatitis C treatment. And then sometimes we have restrictions on who can prescribe hepatitis C medications. So it has to be a gastroenterologist or a hepatologist. In my mind, if you have a primary care physician who's comfortable treating hepatitis C, they should be able to prescribe these medications. So I think if we want to eliminate hepatitis C, and this is actually a goal by the World Health Organization, by 2030, we need to screen everyone, and then when we find it, we need to treat. And unfortunately, as you said earlier, many people with viral hepatitis don't even know that they have it. But then what's the point of making that diagnosis and then saying, well, you're on Medicaid and now we cannot treat you because your disease is not advanced? That creates a lot of anxiety, and in my mind, it's not fair.
Yeah, and go ahead, Dr. Hubbard.
Sorry, and I would also argue that even though the medications are expensive, it's actually cost-effective to treat these patients. If you treat them early on, you cure the virus, you can prevent them from having cirrhosis, prevent cancer, because if you have an untreated patient who eventually might get cirrhosis to the point where you need a liver transplant, the care of taking care of a transplant patient is hundreds of thousands of dollars compared to $20,000 to what we can do up front with treating hepatitis C. So I think it's very short-sighted of Medicaid to not provide coverage for these patients, because in the long run, it's more cost-effective to cure the virus so that you can avoid these long-term consequences if you don't.
Lauren Canary, you must have lots of thoughts about all this. Tell me.
Oh, so many. You know, I worked as an epidemiologist at the CDC on this topic for 5 years. And at the CDC, we were tracking the rates of new infection among babies. And that's going up drastically in the country. And I'm concerned that because a lot of these restrictions won't allow women of childbearing age to get treated, we're seeing many more babies being born with hepatitis C. And we don't currently have any drugs that are approved to treat them until they're in their teenage years. So we're subjecting infants to this when they've had no role in this at all. Also, I'm worried about these requirements that a specialist must be used, because a lot of folks in rural areas just don't have access to an infectious disease specialist. They'd have to travel for hours, especially in a state like Texas. I mean, that could be a huge burden that's unfairly placed on folks in rural areas. And as I mentioned previously, this is illegal. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid have made it clear it's illegal, and cost is no longer an excuse. Just next door in Louisiana, Secretary Rebecca Gee has come up with a plan to buy drugs in bulk to get a really good price on them to ensure that everyone in Louisiana has access to treatment. I'd love to see Texas doing something similar.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had just been reading before the show about buyers clubs springing up around the country and around the world where where it's too expensive for people to access this medication. People selling their homes so that they can buy meds to stay alive. Do you talk with these people on a regular basis?
We do, yeah. We have a connection to patients, which has been really incredible and also devastating. We have folks who are, I just heard from someone last week in West Virginia who's on hospice for her cirrhosis because she can't get treated through her state Medicaid program. And it's just devastating because I can't think of any other medical condition for which we face restrictions on treatment. My mother is going through lung cancer treatment right now with drugs that are just as expensive, these immunotherapies that are new. And there's been no such restrictions placed on her. So the stigma that's associated with hepatitis C is really getting in the way of addressing this public health crisis.
Lauren, Karen from Twitter, she's not from Twitter, but she's on Twitter. She asks, does the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable have plans to perhaps connect patients to care through local health departments?
Absolutely, absolutely. We're very excited to connect folks to local health departments. Unfortunately, addressing viral hepatitis has been fairly underfunded in the country in terms of public health departments. We're working with Congress to try to change that, but in most states, there may be only one person or even a half of a person's physician funded to work on viral hepatitis. So health departments can use all the help they can get. We have a lot of patients who are engaged and ready to support any efforts around elimination, to elevate their voices and talk about their experiences, what does and doesn't work. So for any patients that want to be advocates or interested in connecting with their local health department, we encourage them to go to our website, it's nvhr.org, and sign up for our mailing list to stay tuned on how to be involved.
All right, let's get a caller in right now at 210-614-8980. Betty, tell us what's on your mind.
Back in the 60s, I worked in a blood bank where I drew blood and processed a lot of blood, came in contact with a lot of blood. In the 90s, when I was preparing for surgery, they did a blood workup, and I tested positive for hepatitis C. After that, for several years, my test continued to show a positive result. About 5 years ago, I was tested again, and I'm negative now. I'm curious about how that can be, and did I ever have the disease?
Doctors? Dr. Hubbard?
So we know that about 25% or so of patients can get exposed to the virus, get infected, and their immune systems clear the infection spontaneously without any medication. So for most people, it is a chronic infection, but there is a subset of patients who get infected, but they cure the virus on their own without needing treatment. So that may have been your case at that time.
So if she tests clear of it now, then she's clear of it.
If she tests it clear, then she's clear and doesn't need any medication.
All right. Thank you for that, Betty. And our number again is 210-614-8980. And, you know, I'd like to hear from you if you have hepatitis. What your symptoms may be like, what it feels like, how does it affect your life? If that's you, you can give us a call at 210-614-8980. Let's talk a little bit more about that stigma that Lauren touched on. So her mother's being treated for, you know, lung cancer. And there's no stigma related to it. So she has access to a lot more resources. How does that play out in your clinic, Dr. Alkhouri?
So when we talk about hepatitis B and hepatitis C, as we said, the most common route you get it in the United States is typically through IV drug use, and this is where the stigma comes from, sometimes high-risk sexual behavior. So many of these patients, they acquire hepatitis C because they use the IV heroin, other drugs, and then they're not, you know, being followed regularly by physicians. They're lost to follow-up. So sometimes they go to a rehab facility, they get the diagnosis, they leave, they never see the doctor, they're never connected to a healthcare provider who can treat their hepatitis C. So there's that stigma associated with it. And I think there's a stigma associated with liver disease in general, because I think the public thinks that you only get bad liver disease if you're an alcoholic, if you drink too much alcohol. And we know that this is a subset of patients, but there are so many other different causes. So I think when you say liver disease, it's always something that we stigmatize in our society, and we need to take that stigma out because now the most common causes are typically hepatitis C and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease.
So, Dr. Hubbard, do you have any ideas about how to remove that stigma?
I think it's what we're doing now, getting the word out, educating the public, talking to our patients, and making sure that they understand what's myth versus fact. I have patients come in and they think that they're going to give their loved one hepatitis C by hugging them or shaking their hand. There's a lot of misconceptions about how it's transmitted, and that also leads to stigma, leads to isolation, a lot of feelings of guilt and shame. And so I think in just continuing to provide that public education is the best way of doing that.
So we've talked about several of the strains, but we're going to talk about all of them. So I want to touch for a minute on hepatitis D and hepatitis E. Dr. Hubbard, can you tell me what those are?
So those are different viruses passed in different ways. Hepatitis D is an interesting virus in that hepatitis D requires the presence of hepatitis B in order to infect a patient. Hmm. So it's considered kind of like a super infection on top of hepatitis B. And so we don't treat it directly. If you treat the hepatitis B effectively, then you can also effectively manage hepatitis D. It's a pretty rare.
So it's like a freeloader. It just
kind of like a freeloader, yeah, exactly. It's a very rare, pretty rare that we see that one.
Yeah. And E?
And hepatitis E is similar to hepatitis A in that it's a fecal-oral transmission. So if your hands are dirty, you have stool in your hands, touch your mouth at some point, you can get infected that way. Much more common in developing countries like Africa and Asia and India and the Middle East. And it's considered a self-limiting virus. So people can be sick from fatigue, abdominal pain, maybe get jaundice in rare situations, but it tends to go away on its own with the body's own immune system, and typically passed through food and water, poor sanitation, those sort of conditions.
All right, we're talking about all things hepatitis this afternoon on The Source. Give us a call, 210-614-8980. We'd especially like to hear from you if you live with one of the strains of hepatitis. Tell us how you feel. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org. You can tweet us at @tprsource, and you can be anonymous. So please get involved with this show. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1. I'm Bonnie Petrie. And for David Martin Davies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie. In for David Martin Davies, we're talking about hepatitis today. A, B, C, D, and E. Dr. Hope Hubbard is here. Dr. Naeem Al-Khoury and Lauren Canary of the National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable. And I want to talk about looking ahead. Obviously, we now have a treatment for hepatitis C. Where's the research on treatments and cures for the other versions of hepatitis?
Yeah, great question. So hepatitis B, we actually have effective medications that can suppress viral replication. So that will also help decrease liver enzymes, decrease inflammation in the liver. But we do not have a cure for hepatitis B. So typically, you have to stay on medications for the rest of your life. And this is, you know, a burden on the patients. They have to be compliant. You can also have flares if you don't take your medications. So this is where the research is going now. We want to find the cure for hepatitis B. And we're looking at different therapeutic targets. We have multiple clinical trials now in early drug development trying to find cures for hepatitis B. The issue with hepatitis B, it's a DNA virus. So the DNA from the virus can integrate into the DNA from the human liver cells. And this is what makes it harder to cure. Hepatitis C is what we call an RNA virus, so it does not integrate into the human DNA. But I suspect that within 5 to 6 years, we will start hearing about new treatments for hepatitis B that potentially will provide the cure for these patients. Hepatitis A and E, typically they're self-limited illnesses, so you do not need treatment. However, I want to make a point that hepatitis E in patients who are immunocompromised, so after, you know, receiving kidney transplant, heart transplant, or if you live with HIV, hepatitis E can become become chronic. It can cause chronic hepatitis. And then we do have treatment for it called ribavirin that may work. Sometimes we still have to use interferon for hepatitis E. And then hepatitis D, you know, you have to have hepatitis B with it, but we also have some new treatments that may help cure both viruses at the same time.
So how long before we see something for B, do you think?
I mean, again, we have a lot now in what we call drug development, but they're early phase clinical trials, what we call phase 1 and 2. So you need to do the large trials, what we call phase 3, before you get to FDA approval. So my prediction is 5 years before we start talking about a cure for hepatitis B.
Okay, so we have an email from Sandra. She wants to know more about what treatment is like. Is it pills? Is it shots? What kind of?
Yes, so treatment for hepatitis C today is only pills. We do not need shots anymore. And as I said, the cure rate is 99%. And typically, again, it's just one medication. The medication has, you know, two active ingredients in it, in a way. So you have to target different mechanisms of actions of the viral replication to cure hepatitis C, but it's typically just one pill that you have to take. Hepatitis B is typically one pill once a day as well. And again, these medications are effective to suppress the virus, but you have to take them typically for the rest of your life. So that's why we need a cure for hepatitis B.
Okay. And so it's a treatment that is tolerable if you can afford it.
Yes,
absolutely.
The side effects are minimal. Fatigue, headaches, that's really about it. And most patients come in and say, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, and they tolerate it very well. We've not had any patient that had to stop treatment early for side effects. You can work, you can go to school. It doesn't interfere with your daily activities. So it's a highly tolerated medication.
So Lauren Canaria, with your background at the CDC in epidemiology, does it drive you crazy that we have vaccines for some, we have effective treatment, a cure for another, and yet we still have millions of people with active hepatitis, various versions around the world?
Absolutely. It's devastating. I mean, I think for most infectious diseases, think about HIV, if there was a vaccine available, we'd all be shouting from the rooftops so excited that this existed, and it would be a matter of getting it out. So the fact that we already have this for Hep B, and there's still people that are dying of liver cancer related to hepatitis B is quite devastating. And similarly with hepatitis A. For hepatitis C, what's difficult for me, I think, is that we have such an effective treatment. We have an ongoing epidemic. We're seeing increasing rates of hepatitis C across the country associated with the opioid epidemic. We're seeing cases among babies, among pregnant women. We're seeing an increase in deaths. And the prevalence rate for hepatitis C has actually surpassed all other 60 notifiable infectious conditions combined. So it's really striking, and it's really tough that we're kind of caught up in a policy debate around folks accessing treatment when this is really an epidemic.
And dying of liver disease is not, it's not a pleasant way to die. And so it's... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I tell my patients that, you know, I never want you to develop cirrhosis and stage liver disease, because the complications are typically very limiting in terms of quality of life. So people turn yellow, jaundice, but they also develop what we call ascites, which is fluid in the abdomen, and then they cannot eat. They have decreased appetite. It can affect their breathing. Sometimes they have swelling in their legs. They can also have bleeding from their stomach, esophagus. They can become anemic. They are fatigued, they have memory loss, they feel foggy. So yes, having end-stage liver disease is very devastating. There is also a complication called encephalopathy, where you become confused because the liver cannot detoxify your blood. So definitely something that we want to prevent.
All right, we have a caller. Stephen, what's your question? Oh, we lost Stephen. Wanted to talk related. Hello, Stephen? I could have sworn I heard him. Vaccine for alcoholic hepatitis, is that something you two are aware of?
So alcoholic hepatitis is caused by excessive alcohol consumption. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do not have a vaccine. That would be a wonderful idea. This is the first time I hear someone asking about a vaccine for alcoholic hepatitis. But we actually have, you know, treatments also in development, because many people develop this acute alcoholic hepatitis where they go on a binge drinking episode. They show up to the emergency, jaundice yellow with swelling in the abdomen. And the mortality, the risk of dying, is pretty high. So we are working on, you know, some medications to try to help with this. We also have medications that hopefully can prevent scarring of the liver from alcohol, and that would be ideal to prevent cirrhosis from alcoholic liver disease, but no vaccine for alcohol at this point.
Okay, so Susan sent us an email. She says she was diagnosed with hepatitis A in 1980 and wants to know why she still can't donate blood. Dr. Hubbard?
She should be able to donate even if having hepatitis A. That should not be a contraindication that I know of in terms of donating blood. So it's not, that's, virus is not passed by blood. It's passed, you know, by a fecal oral route and typically infected food and water. So, you know, that it doesn't really add up why she should not be able to donate blood.
All right. Well, let's talk to Donna. She has another question about donating blood. Donna?
Yes, I was diagnosed with hepatitis C in 2000 and went through the 6-month treatment and was considered, like, cured. But will I be able to donate blood again or plasma? I was on the list for bone marrow, but I don't know if now if I'm eligible.
I mean, the issue is when we test for hepatitis C, we have two different kinds of tests. So the first one is the hepatitis C antibody, which is your own immune system's reaction to hepatitis C. So you make these antibodies, and even if you cure hepatitis C, you will always have the antibody positive. So that's why you cannot donate blood even after you cure hepatitis C, just because the blood bank, they run the antibody test, and if you're positive, they say you cannot donate blood. Technically speaking, I mean, are you at risk of infecting another person? No, but this is why they say you cannot donate blood. The test that we use to confirm that you have active hepatitis C, we call it hepatitis C RNA. This is the genetic material from the hepatitis C virus, and this tells you that you have an active infection. And if you do, obviously, you should not donate blood or, you know, other organs. Although, you know, one thing I want to make now, that because of the opioid epidemic, we have people unfortunately dying from drug overdose. And some of them have hepatitis C, and they're young, and they have healthy organs. And because we can cure hepatitis C easily, we are using these organs now. And we use the liver, the kidney, we give it to recipients without hepatitis C, and then we treat them after the transplant, and we cure the hepatitis C. So this is a new development because, you know, historically speaking, it was so difficult to cure hep C. We never actually accepted these organs, but now we do.
Things like not being able to donate blood, though, they add to the stigma, wouldn't you say?
Sure.
Yeah. Lauren, what do you think we need to do to sort of knock down this stigma? And we're going to have to, not Dr. Lauren right there. She's having a little trouble with her line. But yeah, I mean, since 9 out of 10 people have hepatitis and don't know it, people who have it don't know it. Is it something we should screen for every year as a physical, or how do we get more people to know that they're infected?
Actually, there's, you know, arguments that everyone should receive once in a lifetime screening for hepatitis C, because again, the treatment is a cure, and you know, why depend on the patients to tell us that they did IV drugs one time or they had a tattoo in a place that's not so safe? Just screen everyone once in their life. Same thing with HIV infection, you know, just get screened once. For the, you know, to do a repeat testing, I think it's not cost effective because that will add, you know, to the healthcare cost, and you're going to have false positive tests, and that can create a lot of anxiety. But I support screening for hepatitis C once in a lifetime.
So what hepatitis, version of hepatitis, is the greatest concern for folks in San Antonio, Bexar County?
I would say hepatitis C is the most common one that we have in the country, and most common in San Antonio. And so, and that's the one that it's curable. And so I think that's the one we really need to, they're all important for sure, but there's a cure for it. It's underdiagnosed, it's undertreated, and getting the word out, getting the public educated, and hopefully removing these restrictions from treatment will be able to save lives.
And what's the future look like, Dr. Alcori?
I'm optimistic, and I think hepatitis C hopefully will become a rare disease by 2035. I think, you know, the hepatitis B vaccine, we're also making progress, but I'm looking forward for a cure for hepatitis B so patients don't have to take the pills for the rest of their lives. I think by curing hepatitis B, we're going to make an impact for hepatitis D as well. But I'm concerned about the epidemic of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and we have the highest rates in San Antonio.
All right. We'll talk about that soon. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Hope Hubbard, UT Health San Antonio, Dr. Naima Malkuri, also at UT Health San Antonio and the Texas Liver Institute, and Lauren Canary with National Viral Hepatitis Roundtable. You have been listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm Bonnie Petrie, in for David Martin Davies.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.